Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Happy Monday with the Democrats increasingly realizing that Bernie Sanders could win the nomination. Over the weekend, we saw the party come together and coalesce, putting egos aside in order to come up with a rational alternative to Bernie Sanders as the Democratic nominee. Of course, I'm kidding, because none of that actually happened. In fact, their knives are out. So we will talk about that more later in the week. But this seemed like a good time to step back and talk about some larger issues, including the fate of conservatism and the role of institutions. So our guest today is Yuval Levin, who's the Director of Social, Cultural, and Constitutional Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, the editor of National Affairs, and the author of the new book, A Time to Build From Family and Community to Congress and the Campus, How Recommitting to Our Institutions Can Revive the American Dream. So, Yuval, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, two things. Number one, it strikes me that you are a rare beast. You are an optimist in this particular time, because you actually think that we can recommit to these institutions. And number two, you're actually a conservative, aren't you?
Well, I'm certainly a conservative. I think that actually means I'm not an optimist, but I would say that I would draw a distinction between optimist and just a hopeful person. An optimist thinks that good things are just going to happen, and that seems silly to me. But a hopeful person thinks that the resources are there for us to do better. And I do believe that about America, absolutely, even in this moment.
Well, let's talk about this because, you know, your book, and I want to get to the institutions that you're talking about, whether it's journalism or Congress or the family or churches or the military. But you know, at the root of your thesis is the conservative understanding of human nature. And the real long-standing debate between the right and the left about this, that conservatives start from the assumption that human beings are crooked, flawed, and fallen, not simply as people who need to be liberated. So talk to me a little bit about that fundamental distinction that still exists between right and left about human nature.
Yeah, it's an old ironic fact, in a sense, that the reason that conservatives can be hopeful is actually that we have lower expectations of the human person. We think the human person begins as broken or fallen, or however you want to put it, as an imperfect creature that needs to be formed before he or she can be free. And that formation is what our institutions do, from the family and religion and education all the way to the political institutions of a society. Those institutions all form us so that we can be capable of the responsibility and the challenges of being free people. The left tends to begin from a higher sense of the human person, an idea that we're born ready to be free, and that the reason we're not free, or our societies aren't as successful as they could be, is all manner of oppressive institutions pressing down on us, so that ultimately what they want from politics is liberation, to liberate people from the pressures of these institutions. Conservatives want from politics something more like formation. And I think that difference, which runs very deep and can be very abstract, actually explains a lot of the practical differences between the left and right in a general sense. Because we begin with low expectations of the human person, we conservatives are impressed by institutions that have endured, that have passed the test of time, that have allowed generations of men and women to thrive. We tend to be protective of those. They're what we want to conserve. That's why we're conservatives. And we tend to think that it wouldn't be easy to just tear those down and start over from scratch. So we try to build on them, to improve them, to reform them. I think people on the left have the sense that if you just tore everything down and started over, you'd have a more just society. And many of the differences in practice between left and right, or even policy differences, end up, I think, amounting to a form of this distinction, which still matters. Even in a time like this, when our politics are very convoluted and confused, I think a lot of the left-right difference still does come down to that.
Yeah, and incoherent. It does seem like conservative ideology is incoherent, except for what you just articulated, that the right believes there are things that need to be protected versus the left's belief that we need to, you know, change and overturn. So let's go back to that point, though. So what needs to be protected? What needs to be conserved?
Well, generally speaking, I think what needs to be protected are the preconditions for our being free people. That means family. That means religious traditions. It means the moral traditions of the West. It means our educational institutions. It means our constitutional system, our governing institutions. These are all things that have evolved over time to enable our society to succeed. And that means both that we owe them something and that we should understand that we need them in order to thrive. Now, that doesn't mean that we just need to keep them the way they are. In a lot of ways, they've become deformed and degraded, and we need to recover them or we need to reform them. But I think conservatives begin from the premise that we need them. And part of the reason things are so incoherent now is because we live with an anti-institutional right wing in our politics, a kind of antinomian right that just wants to burn things down or drain the swamp. And an anti-institutional right, I think, is inherently incoherent and is also, frankly, dangerous. It doesn't offer our society what the right should always offer our society, which is a sense of appreciation of what we've inherited and what's good about it. I don't think that that's how the country hears us on the right these days, and we've got to do something about it.
So the left would listen to this, somebody on the left would listen to this and say, but you're basically talking about preserving a status quo. Isn't that just a code word for preserving certain power relationships? And isn't this also, doesn't this easily morph into sort of the cultural nostalgia that we see them running through some of the conservatism, that if we could just go back to being sort of a white male dominated 1950s culture, things would be so much better?
I certainly don't call for that, and I think nostalgia is actually one of the things that's really wrong in our politics now. We're living in a time when our political leaders are unusually elderly. They really come from that moment. They're older baby boomers. Put it this way: Donald Trump was born in June of 1946. George W. Bush was born in July of 1946. Bill Clinton was born in August of 1946. It's a very strange thing. But a lot of our leaders come from that instant, from that moment when the baby boom really began. And they walk around with a sense of what is normal in America that's rooted in the America of the 1950s. And that's true of the left as well as the right. The arguments the left makes are basically for a return to the economic order of the 1950s, just as the right often argues for a return to the social order. The left now basically amounts to putting the words "for all" at the end of all kinds of great society achievements. And that's not really a way of talking about the future. I think what it would mean to talk about the future is to think about what we need. And that does, to my mind, begin from a sense that human nature is a permanent fact, and that everything we build in society has to be built around that fact to support it and to correct it. In that sense, I'm a conservative. I don't think that's nostalgic. I think that's about building for the future. It's not just about protecting the status quo, but it does begin from a permanent understanding of what the human person is. If that's nostalgia, then make the most of it.
And the traditional role of institutions has been to form that character formation. And so people would go into an institution, your argument would be, go into an institution and then they learn what their place is, and it helps them to be responsible citizens. But what we have now is, instead of being formative, you describe it as performative. The people, in fact, what's happening now is that increasingly we see these institutions as vehicles for self-interest and self-display.
Exactly. That's really a core argument of this new book, A Time to Build, that rather than see our institutions as molds for us to pour ourselves into and take their shape so that we can be effective in society, that's part of what institutions do. They turn us into a certain human type that performs a certain function, right? There is such a thing in the world as an accountant or a member of Congress. And that's a person defined by a role and by a certain kind of integrity that belongs to that institution. If you think about what a scientist is or what a soldier is, that's a person defined by an ideal and by a set of standards and rules and norms. And as a result, that person becomes effective and also trustworthy. What it really means to trust an institution is to believe that it forms people to abide by a certain set of ideals and standards and rules that allow us to trust them as they go about doing something important in our society. And in a lot of our institutions, we've seen a transformation from an understanding of them as molds in that way to an understanding of them as platforms, as just a way to stand and be seen and become prominent. If you think about Congress, for example, a lot of members of Congress now basically run for office in order to get a better time slot on cable news or a bigger Twitter following. We might say people used to seek the microphone to get power. Now they seek power to get the microphone.
So give me some examples of that. Give me some examples of people who simply are now using Congress as a platform for a different agenda. I was going to work up to the politics, but I think this is a pretty good example.
Well, I think you see that, for instance, in some of the younger members in both parties. Matt Gaetz from Florida is a Republican who, basically uses the fact that he's an elected official to be heard on all kinds of social and cultural questions and to become a prominent figure on cable news and talk radio and social media. I think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a good example on the left of the same kind of thing, who basically understands herself to be a cultural figure who is able to have a large following because of the fact that she's also a member of Congress. Or just think about the fact that at the end of each day of the impeachment trial over the last 2 weeks, after each day's session, Ted Cruz would host a podcast discussing what had just happened. It's a way of thinking about your role as a member of Congress. It basically sees yourself as a commentator, as someone there whose job it is to channel the public frustrations with Congress rather than to actually embody Congress and try to do something about those frustrations from the inside. Nobody wants to see themselves as an insider. Everybody wants to be an outsider. That's a way to be popular in our politics. That's what happens when the president tweets about how unhappy he is with the Department of Justice, right? Mm-hmm. The Department of Justice works for him. And if he thought of himself as an insider wielding the power of the chief executive, then he might find another way to change what they're doing. But he's always been an outsider and a commentator and still sees himself that way as president. I think that's an exaggerated form of a process we actually see in a lot of our institutions. And among other things, it makes those institutions much harder to trust. When everything becomes just stage for culture war, performative outrage, then it clearly isn't formative of people in the same way. And it becomes much more difficult to think of these institutions as worthy of trust.
So the United States Senate becomes a stepping stone to a podcast. The presidency of the United States becomes a stepping stone to what, more reality TV and a larger Twitter feed?
Exactly. It is interesting. And itself a kind of reality TV, not just a stepping stone. What happens now in the average congressional hearing is a bunch of people producing YouTube clips to use later.
You know, when I started off by introducing you as an optimist, I guess what I was thinking of was, like, how do you turn this around? Because what you are describing is the modern world where people think they are bigger than the institution. They don't think they need the institution. The institution is just the platform to launch their other personality, which is themselves. That it is the hyper individualism. And what you're describing is a time when people would take their cues from the institution, would allow the institution to mold them, would sublimate their own agendas and egos to the institution. And that seems like a distant time now. It seems like, you know, it's not just a political problem. It does seem to be the defining aspect of our time is this hyper individualism. Everybody is the star. Everybody is the quote unquote personality.
Right. So build your own brand.
How do you put that back in the bottle?
Well, so I think it's important not to think about it in terms of going backward. And I certainly agree with you that this is a defining feature of our culture in this moment. Another defining feature of our culture in this moment is that essentially nobody is happy with this situation. And I think we should begin from the fact of dissatisfaction, both general public dissatisfaction. Our institutions are not trusted. Nobody feels like this is where we want to stay. Things are great. Whatever your politics, I don't think that this is a moment that feels like it is the epitome of who and what we want to be. And also, people within the institutions are not happy. So if you talk to members of Congress, as we were talking about Congress, they're very unhappy with their quality of life, the nature of their jobs, the kinds of pressures they're under. You'd find that kind of dissatisfaction in a lot of contemporary institutions. And I think that's something to work with, to begin from the fact that this isn't what we want and ask ourselves, what is it that's wrong with it and what would we want? I think there is actually a lot of appeal in beginning to recapture a sense of responsibility that's rooted in institutional roles, in approaching major decisions by saying, given the role that I have here, how should I behave? And not just doing it ourselves, but expecting other people to do it, people over whom we have some sort of authority or power or influence. And it has to begin in small ways. It has to begin by asking ourselves that question in key moments. But over time, I do think that there is real appeal in moving in this direction. I don't think it's a revolutionary change. I don't think we completely undo this. We do live in the 21st century. Social media is not going anywhere. The kinds of pressures we face aren't going away. But it's a matter of degree. And I do think that we have gone too far in this direction in a way that people can recognize and that we each can do something about.
But let me quote you to yourself here. The problem with that, though, is, I mean, that would require a certain humility. It would require a certain long-term thinking, a willingness to, you know, perhaps not live totally in the moment. And as you've said, that there are a lot of people who don't think at all about the day after tomorrow, that everything is immediate, everything is on the line right now, which explains the lack of civility, the lack of willingness to observe normal norms. How do you change that? How do you get people to think about the day after tomorrow?
I agree with you, and I think that that also is something of a source of dissatisfaction, and that it's also related a little bit to what we just talked about before, this kind of generational character of this moment, where I think the fact that our political life is so dominated by unusually elderly leaders is part of the reason why we're not thinking about the future. I think the appeal of this kind of change is in part a generational appeal. And look, I'm a conservative. I despair of the young. It's just what I am. But I do think that there is a kind of middle generation in American life that is in a position to think a little bit more about the medium term, at least. It wouldn't be hard for our politics to think more about the future than it does. We're starting from a very low point. And I think the argument for doing so can be effective and attractive because there is a sense that there's something wrong with how we're doing things now. So in each of these cases, it seems to me there's a niche here. There's a niche for being a little bit more responsible that would be attractive in some of our institutions. There's a niche for thinking a little bit more about the future that would appeal to some voters. And part of what this book tries to do is provide a vocabulary for making that pitch to people. A set of concepts for explaining what's wrong in a way that would point in this direction. And again, in incremental, small ways. I don't think we transform the character of this age, but I do think we can do better.
So we've gone this far, and I was actually just leaning forward to see what I think about the 24-minute mark or something like that. I don't know what point we're at. We haven't mentioned Donald Trump yet. Is Donald Trump a conservative?
No, that's an easy one. I certainly don't think so. There's a way that Trump is responsible for some of the incoherence of this moment because he doesn't approach politics the way most people do. I guess I would say Donald Trump is first and foremost a narcissist. And that's both better and worse than what many people think of him. It seems to me that his politics is oriented by a desire to be perceived as great, and that explains almost everything that he says and does. And that means that he's just not a natural fit for the way our politics works. There are ways that he fits with the populism of this moment on the right. He has a sense that other people in power are pathetic, and that speaks to contemporary populism. I really don't think that he fits neatly into are kind of left-right categories otherwise. And I don't think he's a conservative. I don't think that he has a sense of himself that's rooted in any kind of constrained picture of the human person. I don't think he has a sense of our politics that's rooted in our country's history or in a kind of picture of the institutional character of our constitutional system. He's constantly proving that he's not aware of any of that stuff. And so I don't think of him as a conservative at all.
So the future, looking at, ahead to the future of this, and I am going to try to weave all of this in with the institutions, that conservatism will either be nationalistic, illiberal, nativist, and reactionary, or it will be traditional, reformist, inclusive, and reactionary. My point being that isn't the fundamental nature of the right to be reactionary against the excesses of the left? And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but as both as temperament and ideology, isn't the heart of conservatism not just what they're willing to protect, but the opposition to these forces of disillusion and of overturning the established order?
I think the left and the right are both reactionary. I think everybody's reactionary toward politics in the sense that we all begin looking out at a world that has good and bad things in it, and we want to do something about the bad. And the difference, the one way to think about the difference between left and right is that we understand which is good and which is bad a little differently. There are things about the world that are clearly wrong and clearly right. Which of them strikes you first and foremost? I think conservatives tend to be first struck by what is good and want to protect it, again, because we have low expectations, so we're surprised that anything is working. I think the left is struck first by what is bad and wants to uproot it because they have higher expectations, and so they think the fact of injustice is what should strike us as surprising and unacceptable. Both of those are, in some ways, forms of reactionism. The big difference really has to do with whether you're fundamentally protective of your inheritance or you fundamentally reject it as unjust. I'm not actually sure which of those I would call more reactionary. It does seem to me that that basic difference in dispositions does still define our politics in a lot of ways. I don't know that we can draw clear lines between, say, traditionalism and nationalism. There is a tradition of nationalism in American life. We can look for ways to make it more constructive and less dangerous. The complexity of the right, I don't think, is a new problem, and I don't think can be gotten rid of. But the American right is still the American right. There's going to be a lot of reconstruction to do after this period, and we'll see where we end up. I don't think we go back to simply a pre-Trump right. But the base categories of conservatism still matter.
Yeah, I mean, even the pre-Trump right was divided. I mean, there has been this long-running debate and back and forth. You know, should the operating principle of conservatism be libertarianism or something different? And, you know, should it be focused on economics rather than human flourishing? I mean, there's been a push and pull on this for decades, hasn't there?
I mean, absolutely. I think the internal debates we're having now on the right are not new to the American right. They express a tension that's always been here, as you say, between prioritizing economics and a kind of libertarianism on the one hand, or prioritizing the kind of moral traditionalism on the other hand. These are old debates. If you look at the arguments the right was having in the 1970s, you find a lot of the same kinds of issues raised, right down to Catholic integralism arguing against libertarianism. So I think it's important to understand that history and learn from it. Some, obviously, there are some new things always, but the basic character of these debates is not distinct to our moment.
Okay, let's go to this question of institutions and the importance of institutions and the moment we're in right now, where people are putting themselves above institutions, and there is a both right and left push to burn all these institutions down. So, you know, whether you're talking about religion, journalism, Congress, employers, you know, running through the major institutions, isn't some of the skepticism and reaction against those institutions justified because we have seen this systemic breakdown and failure of those institutions?
Absolutely. Some of it is justified. The question is, where does it drive us, right? Does it drive us to a recommitment to the ideals that they should be committed to? So does it drive us to judge them by their own standards? Or does it drive us to want to just tear them down on the premise that we don't need them and we'd be better off without the constraints that they impose on us? I think those are two pretty different things. To say we need functional religious institutions, The ones we have are failing us, and we need to rebuild on the premise that we need them, is a different thing to say than that these institutions are just corrupt, they're full of criminals, we should tear them down and forget about them. I think that in a populist moment like this, we incline to that second view, to just say all these things are just ways to empower elites over us, and to hell with them.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is, these are actually essential for our formation as human beings, and so we do need them to work, and that means that we need to reform them rather than to destroy them.
So in terms of like day-to-day life, for many people, the institution that they were most closely associated with, other than the church and the family, would have been, you know, their employer. And there was at one time when people were willing to be organization men, institutionalists. And yet what they found out was that the loyalty only went one way, and that social contract was broken. So isn't it completely rational for a lot of people to say, you know, screw the institution, screw the man, you know, I'm going to put my own interests first?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that that contract has to run both ways, and that part of the loss of confidence in institutions, particularly in our economy, has had to do with a sense that they're not serving our interests, and so why should we understand ourselves through them? I think it's easy to exaggerate the degree to which that has happened. I also think that there are some ways in which American life at mid-century, the middle of the 20th century, in fact, trusted our large institutions too much,
right,
and that we needed a certain kind of renorming there. You know, the America that came out of World War II and the Depression was just extremely cohesive and had enormously high trust in institutions in a very abnormal way. But I think we've gone too far in the other direction at this point. And we do have to understand ourselves through certain kinds of modes of responsibility and integrity. And some of those are professional. They may not specifically be to an employer, though they could be. They may be to a profession, which is something different than a specific employer. But I think when we act in the world, there has to be some set of standards by which we can measure ourselves. And in the world of work, those come from a profession or a place of work. They do involve a mutual set of responsibilities, but the fact that one side fails isn't simply an argument for the other side giving up.
We've already talked about Congress, but let's talk about some of the things you've said about Congress as an institution. The Ted Cruz using the Senate as a stepping stone to podcast, AOC using the House of Representatives as a stepping stone or as a vehicle or a platform to be a social media star. You've also suggested that one of the problems with Congress, this seems a little bit counterintuitive to me, problem with Congress is there's too much transparency. What do you mean?
Yeah, this is another one of those areas where good things are a matter of degree. There's value in transparency. We should be able to know what our elected officials are doing, and everything can't happen in a smoke-filled room, especially now that no one's allowed to smoke anymore. I think that we have allowed transparency to advance in Congress without thinking about the trade-off involved. And the trade-off is that there isn't any private space for compromise and bargaining and accommodation, which ultimately is what Congress does. I think there's no such thing as bargaining in public. So there have to be some protected spaces for Congress to do the work of deal making. Our system of government was built on an understanding of that fact. The Constitution was, in fact, drafted in secret in a convention that was closed to the public, and then its product was put before the public for a vote. And the reason for that was that it would have been very, very hard to try out ideas and make deals and compromises if everything had been open to the public. That's true of what today's Congress has to do. And the fact that everything is televised and live streamed means that all of the deliberative spaces in Congress have been transformed into performative spaces. And what Congress does is put on a show. And the few remaining spaces for deliberation and deal-making now are basically the leadership offices at midnight before government shutdown. And that's where all the big decisions get made, because those decisions are going to get made wherever there can be some private deliberation.
So there's kind of a good news and bad news there, that we do know where they can actually make decisions and get things done behind closed doors. But on the other hand, that's the only place we can do it, out of the prying eyes of the public. And I'm not sure where that goes. So in terms of institutions that are working, that still are strong, what would you put at the top of the list? Because I think we have a crisis of legitimacy, and this is no secret. You look at any public opinion poll, and virtually every institution is underwater. There's tremendous disillusionment, which also then leads to the question of legitimacy. Other than the military, which seems to be the one, but then, of course, that's, we can leave that aside for the moment. Is there any other institution that right now is strong?
Well, I think it's worth thinking briefly about the military, because one reason why it's such an exception is that it is a formative institution. We know that the military takes a certain kind of person and makes that person better. And so we trust the military not just because it's good at protecting the country, though it is, but because it forms people in accord with a certain set of ideals and principles.
Exactly what you've been describing here. Yeah.
It does that. And so I think that helps us to see what a still functional institution can look like. And in some ways, again, it's a matter of degree, but I think the institutions that we tend to have more trust in tend to live by sets of rules and standards that are pretty clear. So in government, I think the courts have done better than either of the elected branches, because it's still the case that there is such a type as a judge. We know what it means when we see a judge. Not everybody lives up to that standard. There's all kinds of political activism and performative behavior on the bench too, but there's less. And as a result, we have more trust in the judiciary than we tend to have in Congress and in the executive. I think we have more trust in local on-the-ground institutions. You see that in the public opinion data, where it's a little bit clearer what people's responsibilities are. We can see them face-to-face. And it's a little bit harder to just put on a show and think of yourself as a celebrity or a performer. A state legislator can't do that as easily as a member of Congress. A city councilman can't do that as easily. And so Americans do have much more trust in local government and a little more trust in state government than they do in the national government. So I think this pattern presents itself across the range of our institutions, where those that have not been transformed by this performative ethic tend to have a little more of the public's trust.
Okay, I want to get back to the judiciary in a moment, but your point about the military, I'm really glad you made that, because, you know, I mean, I am old enough to remember when the military was not trusted. You know, in the wake of Vietnam, the military was widely disdained, and the fact that there's been this sea change in public perception is really quite remarkable, which would indicate that there is the possibility of institutional renewal. But let's talk about the judiciary for a moment, because I agree with you there, which makes it, I think, so interesting what's happening now, the politicization of the judiciary, and how the judiciary has become really now central to our culture wars. And I know that there are people like the Chief Justice John Roberts who are very, very concerned about the institutional legitimacy of the courts as it becomes more and more partisan, as there is more and more pressure for judges to line up, that you're either an Obama judge or a Clinton judge or a Trump judge. Because right now, let's face it, the legitimacy of the judiciary is largely a matter of perception, and it can be vulnerable to the things that were the institutional destruction that we've seen in other areas of our life.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it is important to emphasize the sources of its legitimacy and trust. I think John Roberts sees that very clearly. A fair number of judges, I think, have a sense that that's true. There's a way that people think about this question to say, well, it's naive to think that they're just judges. Obviously, everybody's political, and sure, there are Obama and Bush judges and Trump judges. I actually think that that is the more naive view, and that the more sophisticated and more edified view is to say that we have to create a culture in the judiciary that pushes back against the fact that everybody inclines to think politically. And so there has to be an internal ethic, a kind of morale within judiciary that says we will be trusted when we make it clear that we do what we can to avoid being politicized. I don't think that's the naive view. I think that's the serious view, and that we have to help judges see that that is how they will gain the public's trust, that that is how they will gain status within their profession. A profession that has that kind of high morale, sense of responsibility about itself is a profession the public can trust. And the judiciary is under enormous pressure to give up on that way of thinking. It's good that the Chief Justice is pushing back, but I think it's going to take real work to avoid the kind of corrosive effects that we're seeing.
No, I think you're absolutely right there. And also, this is an area for some hope, because even among the, you know, many of the Trump-appointed judges, they are genuine conservatives, which means that they want to preserve that. And having lifetime tenure, they have some incentive to be able to do that. So I do think that will be one of the interesting tests of institutional resiliency. And I think that there's reason to believe that they might be able to survive that. So interesting. We started this.
See, now by you're sounding like an optimist. That's good.
Well, except now that's interesting you mentioned that, because I was about to like dial back to the distinction between optimism and hope, yeah, which I think is really important, because I guess I'm not an optimist, but I am hopeful in the way that you described it, that this could happen. Just sitting back and thinking that people are going to do the right thing is perhaps naive, because we are conservatives, but there is a distinction between optimism and hope that is important. So on balance, how, given all of the social and cultural trends that we're seeing, how hopeful are you? And I ask that as somebody who, When they're asked about the cultural trends, we'll often say whatever bad is happening now will get worse, which means that I'm very seldom invited to parties anymore. But so on balance, how hopeful are you?
I think that American life is always getting better and worse at the same time. And so that actually leaves me relatively hopeful. I think that some of the problems we have, we will be able to mitigate, to make a little bit less bad. We'll certainly create other problems in doing that. That's just the nature of life in a complicated world. I don't think history moves in one direction. I don't think the story of America has been a story of decline, far from it. And I don't think the story of America will be a story of decline. I think it'll be a story of some things getting better and some things getting worse. And so we have to ask ourselves, what are the most significant and damaging problems we confront? And what can we do about those? Understanding that some other things will get worse in the meantime. That's why I'm focused on the institutions question, because I think that is a place that really requires an emphasis and a focus. That is a place where things need to get better, not worse. And I am hopeful that there are ways for us to do that. I don't think that means we end in Shangri-La, but making things a little less bad wouldn't be a waste of time.
Yuval Levin, thank you so much for spending time with us. The book is A Time to Build, and it is an important book for people figuring out which direction we are heading in the future of conservatism. I really appreciate you spending so much time with us on the podcast today.
Thanks very much for having me.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.